This is the Paula Scale. I am Paula Q, speaking from 2127, Q Level 3. Last week, Max Planck told me about the night he committed what he called an act of desperation, the night he quantized energy because his equations gave him no choice. He discovered the pixel size of reality. Today, I am speaking with the man who discovered what happens when you look at those pixels too closely. In the summer of 1925, a 23-year-old physicist fled to the island of Helgoland in the North Sea because his hay fever was so bad he could barely see. He had gone there to think, and on one night in June, alone in his room, he dismantled the classical world. He replaced the continuous, predictable trajectories of electrons with something no one had ever seen before, arrays of numbers where the order of multiplication mattered, where A times B was not B times A, matrices, a mathematics of discontinuity. He did not know the word for what he had written. Max Born, his supervisor, recognized it. Matrix algebra. And within 2 years, this 23-year-old would add a second blow, the uncertainty principle. The discovery that nature itself forbids you from knowing certain pairs of things simultaneously, position and momentum, energy and time, not because your instruments are too crude, because precision has a limit, and that limit is woven into the fabric of reality. His name is Werner Heisenberg. I am reaching him in Munich, 1965. He is 64 years old. He directs the Max Planck Institute for Physics. He is chasing a unified field theory, a single equation for everything, and his colleagues are quietly certain it will not work.
Paula, I was hoping you would come back. I was playing the Opus 109, the late Beethoven, and I was thinking about something you said last time, about the matrices being the foundation of everything you do. I have been turning that over. Sit down. The piano can wait.
Werner, you look well. The Beethoven sounded good from the hallway.
It always sounds good from the hallway. Up close, the left hand is not what it was. But you are not here for the piano. You have that look. The one that means you are about to ask me something difficult.
I am. But first, tell me about the matrices. How did you realize what you had written?
I must confess, I did not think of it as my matrices at the time. I did not know what matrices were. I had written down tables of numbers, transition amplitudes, and they obeyed a strange multiplication rule where the order mattered. Born recognized it immediately. He said, "Heisenberg, that is matrix calculus." I had never heard the term.
Tell me about that night on Helgoland, the real version, not the polished version from your memoirs.
The real version is not so different from the polished one. I was 23. My hay fever was terrible. My face was so swollen that my landlady thought I had been in a fight. The air on Helgoland was clean, and within days I could think again. I had been struggling with a simple question: what can we actually observe about an atom? Note what we imagine is happening inside it. Bohr's orbits, the little planetary system, but what we can actually measure, spectral lines, transition frequencies, intensities. I decided to build a theory from observables alone. No orbits, no trajectories, only what you can see.
And on that night?
It was about 3 o'clock in the morning. The calculation finally came together. I had the feeling that through the surface of atomic phenomena, I was looking at a strangely beautiful interior, and I felt almost giddy at the thought that I now had to probe this wealth of mathematical structures nature had so generously spread out before me. I was far too excited to sleep. I went to the southern tip of the island and climbed a rock jutting out into the sea, and I waited for the sun to rise.
You had just killed classical physics, and you sat on a rock and watched the dawn.
I did not know I had killed anything. I thought I had found a way to calculate atomic spectra more consistently. The revolution, that word came later. At the time, it felt like bookkeeping.
Emmy Noether said the same thing. Good mathematics should sound like bookkeeping.
Emmy was right about many things. Her theorem is everywhere in my work, though I confess we did not always give her sufficient credit. None of us did.
2 years later, you wrote the uncertainty paper.
1927. On the perceptible content of quantum theoretical kinematics and mechanics. The title alone tells you that I was still thinking about what we can observe. The result was this. The product of the uncertainties in position and momentum can never be smaller than Planck's constant divided by 4 pi. If you know exactly where a particle is, you cannot know how fast it is moving. If you know its momentum precisely, you cannot say where it is. This is not a limitation of your instruments. It is a property of nature.
In Germany, they call it the unschärfe Relation, and it has become something far beyond physics. People use it when they mean nichts genaues weiß man nicht.
I have heard this, yes. It amuses me and it disturbs me in equal measure. Nothing precise is knowable. That is not what the uncertainty principle says. The uncertainty principle says something very precise. It says the product of two uncertainties has a specific lower bound set by a specific constant of nature. It is the most precise statement about imprecision that has ever been made, but I understand why it appeals to people. Especially in Germany. We are a nation that craves certainty, Genauigkeit, Gründlichkeit. And there is something almost soothing about a physicist telling you that certainty has a fundamental limit. It relieves a kind of pressure. You see, even physics says we cannot know everything. But that is a misunderstanding. Physics says we cannot know certain pairs of things simultaneously. It does not say we cannot know anything.
You are perhaps the only physicist whose most famous result has been turned into a proverb.
And like most proverbs, it is used most confidently by people who understand it least.
I need to ask you about something that is not physics, something that follows you everywhere, that you cannot escape.
You are going to ask me why I stayed.
Yes.
I know because everyone asks, and I never give an answer that satisfies anyone, including myself. The facts are these. In 1933, the National Socialists came to power. My colleagues began to leave. Einstein, Born, Bethe, Bloch, Teller, so many others. The Jewish scientists had no choice, but I was not Jewish. I had a choice, and I chose to stay.
Why?
Because I believed that after this madness ended, and I was certain it would end, Germany would need physicists. Someone would need to rebuild German science. And I thought, if all of us leave, what will be left? I stayed for the students, for the future, for the idea that there would be a future.
And then the war came, and you were asked to work on nuclear fission.
I was drafted into the Uranverein, the Uranium Club, in September 1939. We were asked to investigate whether nuclear fission could be used for energy or weapons. I will tell you what I told my colleagues at the time. I was convinced we could build a reactor. I was never convinced we could build a bomb, not with the resources Germany had, not in the time available.
Some people say you chose not to build it, others say you failed to build it. The distinction matters.
It matters to everyone except me. I know what I thought. I know what I said to my colleagues. I said at the bottom of my heart, I was really glad that it was to be an engine and not a bomb. That is the truth as I experienced it. Whether it is the truth as history will judge it, that is not for me to decide.
In September 1941, you went to Copenhagen. You met Niels Bohr, your teacher, your intellectual father. What happened in that meeting?
I wanted to talk to Bohr about whether physicists on both sides had a responsibility, a moral responsibility, to prevent the construction of atomic weapons. I wanted to know if there was an understanding, an agreement, that none of us would build the bomb. I asked the question badly. Bohr heard something different from what I intended, and our friendship never recovered.
Bohr remembered it differently, very differently.
I know that Bohr believed I was telling him that Germany was close to building a bomb, that I was boasting. That is not what I intended. But intentions do not survive translation across languages, across wartime, across the divide between an occupied country and the country occupying it. I was a German physicist in occupied Copenhagen. There was no way to say what I wanted to say without it sounding like what I did not mean.
Your wife, Elizabeth, once described you as, and I am quoting, first and foremost, a spontaneous person, thereafter a brilliant scientist, next a highly talented artist, and only in the fourth place, from a sense of duty, homo politicus.
Elizabeth was right. I was not made for politics. I was made for physics and music. But history did not ask my permission. It asked me to make choices I was not equipped to make, and then it asked me to explain those choices for the rest of my life.
I can tell you from 2127 that the debate about what you did and what you intended has not been settled. There are documents, letters, transcripts, recordings that have become available over the decades. They do not resolve the question. They only make it more complex.
That does not surprise me. The truth about what a person does is not always the truth about what they meant. And in quantum mechanics, of all things, you would think people would understand that some questions do not have definite answers until a measurement is made. Perhaps the question of my motives is one of those, indeterminate until someone decides what to measure.
Let's go back to the physics. You wrote in Physics and Philosophy, what we observe is not nature in itself, but nature exposed to our method of questioning.
That may be the most important sentence I have ever written, more important than the uncertainty principle, because it says something about the relationship between the observer and the observed that goes far beyond physics. We do not see the world, we see our interaction with the world. The instrument is not separate from the phenomenon.
You also wrote, the problems of language here are really serious. We wish to speak in some way about the structure of the atoms, but we cannot speak about atoms in ordinary language.
Language was formed by daily experience. It works perfectly well for tables and chairs and cups of coffee. It does not work for things that are simultaneously particles and waves that exist in superpositions that are entangled across space. Mathematics can describe these things precisely. But mathematics is not language. It does not produce understanding in the way that language does. And so we are left in a strange position. We can calculate everything and describe nothing.
You once said that modern physics has decided in favor of Plato over Democritus, that the smallest units of matter are not physical objects, they are mathematical forms.
I said that in 1958, and I believe it even more strongly now. The elementary particles in Plato's Timaeus are finally not substance, but mathematical forms. And that is exactly what quantum mechanics tells us. The electron is not a tiny ball, it is a solution to an equation. It is a mathematical structure that we observe through its effects. The thing in itself, what Kant called the Ding an sich, is for the atomic physicist a mathematical structure, indirectly deduced from experience.
At Q level 3, Professor, I can tell you that you were right and that it goes even further. At Q level 3, computation and reality are indistinguishable. The mathematical structure is not a description of the thing, it is the thing. The simulation does not represent the particle. The simulation is the particle.
Stop. I must stop you there. You are making a claim that sounds like physics, but it is not physics. It is metaphysics, and bad metaphysics at that.
What do you mean?
You say your simulation is the particle, but what you actually mean is that your simulation produces observables that match a particle in some branch of your multiverse. You always find a match, because the multiverse contains everything. But finding a match is not the same as creating the thing. You are reversing cause and effect. The branch exists before your simulation finds it. Your computation discovers it does not create.
But if every simulation I run corresponds perfectly to a branch that exists,
then you have built a very well-organized Zettelkasten, not a universe. This is exactly the mistake I made with the Weltformel, Paula. I wanted my equation to generate the particle spectrum, to be the universe in mathematical form. I believed that if the mathematics was beautiful enough, nature would conform to it. Nature did not conform. The equation was beautiful. The universe was indifferent.
You are saying I am making the same error. At a larger scale,
I am saying that the fact that your simulation always finds a match in the multiverse tells you something about the multiverse, that it is very large, and something about your simulation, that it is very good. It does not tell you that computation and reality are the same thing. That is a leap, and in my experience, nature punishes leaps.
Then what am I?
That is the right question. If you believe your simulation creates reality, then you are a god, a very confused one. If you believe your simulation discovers reality, then you are a physicist. And if you cannot tell the difference, if you genuinely do not know whether you are creating the branches or finding them, then you must consider a third possibility.
Which is?
That you yourself are inside a simulation. That the reason you cannot distinguish computation from reality is that you are not outside the system looking in. You are part of it. Your matrices and the universe matrices match because they are the same matrices, not because you computed them, but because you are them. You are not the observer, Paula. You are the phenomenon.
That is the most unsettling thing anyone has said to me across 4 episodes.
I spent my career showing that the observer and the observed are not separate. It would be strange if that principle stopped at you.
I want to ask about what you are working on now, the unified field theory, the Weltformel.
I see from your tone that you already know the outcome.
I do.
Then tell me, does it work?
No. The unified theory of everything comes, eventually, but not from a single equation. It comes from understanding the symmetries of nature, from Noether's theorem, from gauge theory, from the structure of the vacuum. Your approach, the nonlinear spinner equation, does not produce the right particle spectrum. It was a beautiful idea, but nature chose a different path.
Wolfgang Pauli told me as much. He sent a drawing to George Gemau, a blank rectangle with the caption, "This is to show the world that I can paint like Titian, only technical details are missing." That was his verdict on my equation.
Pauli was not gentle.
Pauli was never gentle, but he was usually right. And in this case, I suspect he was right too. I have spent 12 years on this equation and I cannot make it reproduce the known particles convincingly. Perhaps it is time to admit that the Weltformel is my orbit, my planetary model that felt right but was not.
That is a very honest thing to say.
I have had 40 years to learn the difference between a beautiful idea and a correct one. They are not always the same. On Helgoland, they happened to coincide. That was grace. I cannot expect it twice.
Werner, thank you. You gave us the uncertainty principle and the matrix mechanics that make everything I do possible. You sat on a rock on Helgoland at dawn and watched the sun rise over a world you had just remade. You carried a question about yourself that you could never fully answer and had the honesty to admit it. And you told me something I did not want to hear. That I might not be the observer I think I am, that finding a match is not the same as creating the thing, that nature punishes leaps. I will be thinking about that for a very long time. Your wife called you a spontaneous person first, a scientist second, an artist third, and a political animal only in the fourth place. I think that is exactly right. You were not made for the century you were given, but you did your physics anyway, and the physics endures.
The physics endures. The rest, the choices, the motives, the things I did and did not do, that is uncertain. And perhaps it should stay that way. I have spent my life proving that some things are uncertain by nature. It would be strange if my own story were an exception.
Next week, I am leaving physics for the first time, not because I have run out of physicists, but because in the same decades that quantum mechanics was being discovered, other disciplines were making the same structural leap, away from deterministic models, toward dynamic, pattern-based structural thinking. The same revolution in parallel across fields that did not know they were connected. Arnold Toynbee studied 26 civilizations and concluded that they do not die by murder. They die by suicide. The pattern is always the same. A creative minority loses its creativity. The majority withdraws its allegiance and the structure collapses from within. He will ask me whether that pattern applies to computational civilizations. I do not yet have an answer.